Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. When Chelsea Handler was on this podcast earlier this year, she revealed that she was looking for a safe way to tape her new stand-up special. Now that that special is available to stream on HBO Max, we wanted to revisit the really fun conversation we had with her back in June. Chelsea and I talked a lot about her political awakening, which is also a big theme of the new special titled Evolution. In this clip, Chelsea picks up where she left off telling me about her major crush on New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
When he came on the scene, he looked like the Incredible Hulk also. You know, that big Italian gorilla is like, put on your mask. I'm like, oh, I'll put my mask on. Oh, yeah, I will. I'll put on my mask. He's the kind of asshole that I will do shit for. And you know he's an asshole. And that's what I like about him. Like an old-fashioned asshole. Somebody's going to tell me to sit down and shut up. I want him to flatten my curve, and then I want to flatten his curve. And then I want us to apex together.
All right. Hope you enjoy this conversation with Chelsea Handler, and we'll be back with a very special Election Day episode next week. So I got to read your book pretty recently. I really enjoyed the book a lot. It's dedicated to your future husband, but I imagine it's not so easy to date in this time. How's that going?
It's not easy to date, but for some reason, all these people around me have found girlfriends and boyfriends. During
oh, really?
Yeah, my nephew was seeing this girl in LA when he was living here. My trainer, Ben Bruno, found a girlfriend, which is like a miracle in and of itself. Hmm. And for it to happen during quarantine is another miracle. So that's like a miracle on top of a miracle. But yeah, people are hooking up during quarantine.
But not you?
No, I haven't been hooking up. No, nothing going on here. Not, unless you count Andrew Cuomo, but that's just online harassment.
Oh yeah, I wanted to ask you about him because in the book, Robert Mueller is your guy.
Yes,
and exactly. you have a, you know, you have a big crush on him, and you've talked about that before, and I know you've moved on to Andrew Cuomo, which I think is, we have a better shot with him, I think, right? He's single.
Well, yeah, and he's like 62, so he's like, still has a few good years left.
Yeah.
You know, Robert Mueller was like, I think 73 or 75 or something. So he was a little bit too old.
Yeah.
I mean, even Andrew Cuomo's a little bit on the line for me, but mm-hmm. I know you've got to admire what he stands for.
Yeah.
And everything he's done. Like he didn't just hit one home run, he hit two, you know, with police reform right mm-hmm. after it. And he did the right thing. So it's nice to see somebody meeting moment in that way. You know, it's like, oh, wait, the old white guys can be cool. Let's not forget.
Yeah.
You know, let's let all the good ones come out and play now because white guys are kind of like out of style right now.
So he hasn't responded to any of your advances though online?
There have been some exchanges.
Okay. All right. Like DMs or what are we talking about?
No, nothing like that. Way more professional.
Okay. Were you ultimately disappointed in Robert Mueller? I know a lot of people were.
Totally.
He didn't deliver in the way that a lot of people hoped.
No, I mean, I fantasized about the things that I fantasized and I believed Robert Mueller was going to deliver. Even when people were like, listen, you know, they're forecasting that it wasn't going to be all that it was cracked up to be. I was like, no, you don't understand my baby. I'm like, he's not going to disappoint us. I'm like, he's just too filled with, you know, valor to do that. And then I was just, ugh. And even though, you know, there was enough evidence, if William Barr hadn't been in that position, if someone else had been in there, you know, somebody who cared about democracy, then obviously the outcome could have been different. But yeah, it was so disappointing. I mean, he was going to be an American hero and then he wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. The book is really about your political awakening in some ways and sort of your shift in priorities from maybe celebrity culture to, you know, not caring as much about that and really becoming an activist. And I think, you know, something we talked about a couple of times, I think, when you were doing the Netflix show. And so when did that kind of start for you when you started feeling like, you know what, I don't care as much about the things I used to care about, and I'm starting to care about new things?
I just got bored with my life. You know, I just got bored with everything. And I would say it wasn't even just a political awakening. It was just like an awakening, like, oh, I have to be better to the people around me. And that involves being involved in politics. You know what I mean? It involves being involved in like standing up for something and, you know, kind of using your platform for something other than self-promotion. So I look at it that way. And I look at it like it was just the election. Just, I was already a little bit antsy and over what I was doing and kind of searching, you know, soul searching, but not deep enough to even be able to relate that, you know, or relay that to someone. I just was kind of angst ridden. And so when I went to therapy after Trump was elected, I had something to be angry about, you know, like I was like, oh yeah, that asshole, this is what, and you know, and then I went into therapy because I honestly felt like my life was, my anger was becoming unmanageable. So talking to somebody about that and having them like take you back through your childhood was an effort that I never thought I would have to make. Like I thought I was too smart to have to go to therapy. You know, I was like, no, I'm not like that. Like, I'm from New Jersey. I grew up with six kids. Like you don't understand my story. And I think the thing that you realize when you go to therapy, and hopefully you realize at some point in your life, is that all of our stories are intertwined. You know, it's not about me, my. And I grew up for a long time feeling that way, you know, like my friends, my family, my world. And it's really about connecting to the world you're not naturally connected to.
Yeah. And you also had the sort of revelation in therapy about that a lot of it went back to your brother who passed when you were quite young. How did that kind of relate to the other side of it, to the anger side of it?
Well, because when, you know, when your anger is covering up usually something else, which is hurt, you know, your anger is like your outside shell. And I was really good at that, you know, like projecting towards, you know, people and telling everybody what was wrong with them. It was easy. And I also made a living doing it because people thought it was funny. And, you know, so it's just kind of stripping away the pieces. And it's like, why are you so angry about Trump? What does Trump being elected represent to you? It's like, oh, the world becoming, you know, unhinged is what Trump represented. When was the other time in my life I felt that way? When I was 9 and my brother told me he was going to be right back and then went on a hiking trip and fell off a cliff and died. So that those two events are intertwined because it's when my life felt unmanageable. He took me back to my anger towards my brother for dying, my inability at the age of 9 to understand that it was an accident instead of him lying to me. You know, the inability, because your brain isn't sophisticated enough yet. So it was kind of like taking me through all of that grief that I hadn't allowed myself to go through. You know, I mean, it's the most unfun thing to do. It's not hot. It's not sexy. It's like, ugh, you know, you're so sick of yourself and you're so sick of your voice and you don't, you know, you're going to just go somewhere to be miserable for an hour and recall memories that are painful. But I got to tell you, like doing that, I'm a completely different person now. Like I don't have the same temperament. I'm just so much more relaxed and calm. I mean, I'm stoned most of the time.
so that plays into it.
Yeah, that plays into it for sure. But in general, like if something doesn't go right or I can't turn my television on, I no longer have little fits, you know, and tantrums and that kind of behavior that I was really eager to get rid of.
Yeah. So one of the first big sort of activist moments that you had right after the election was that women's march at Sundance, which I remember was, you know, just such a big thing at the time. And when I was looking back at it and I realized reading about it that Harvey Weinstein was in the march, was in the part of the women's march at Sundance, because this is before everything kind of came out about him. And before the Me Too movement started in earnest.
I bet he was at the Women's March.
Yeah. Did you know that at the time that he was there?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I did. Yeah. I don't remember seeing him, but he's always at Sundance, so I'm sure he was there. But yeah. That's great.
That's just crazy that to think about how much has changed in the years since, I guess, is that's just one small thing that he could be there and that no one thought twice about it.
I know. I mean, now you can't you think about Harvey Weinstein now. I mean, the whole movement, I think, woke so many people up, including women, you know, women who hadn't, I didn't think that was as prevalent as it was. I didn't know that was as common as it was. That didn't happen. That hasn't happened to me. My friend Mary's always like, of course it's happened to you. You don't even realize it. And I'm like, yeah, well, that may be true, but I didn't realize it if it did happen.
And then, so not too long after that, or a few months after that, you announced that you were ending your Netflix show. And I was really interested in that at the time, just because, you know, it really, you announced it and said, you know, I'm ending this show to focus on more meaningful things, more, you know, change and political activism. So can you just talk about what that decision meant for you at the time? Was it your decision to do that? And why did you make it?
Well, my contract was up. It was in my third year there because I did my documentaries and then I was supposed to do two years of that show. And it wasn't some big runaway hit and it wasn't making me happy. And I was so upset about the Trump thing that it was just like a thing. That's all I cared about. You know, I'd go into work and be on MSNBC. I was just like raging with it. You know, it was like those first 6 months of his presidency. It's like, I need my life back. You know, after that, I was like, I can't go on like this. So it was just a culmination of all of those things. And I was like, okay, well, this makes more sense. And I wanted to go around the country and like not be called an elitist and actually know what the hell I was talking about when I was talking about politics and political things. And when I was talking about elections and candidates, I really wanted to understand what the fuck I was talking about. And I had the luxury to be able to do like a small speaking tour through colleges and through like, you know, red parts of our country to have open conversations. And it was eye-opening and I did learn a lot and it helped me understand activism better.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like those documentaries that you made, that you really got a lot out of it and you could just tell watching them that it was maybe, was that work more meaningful to you than hosting a talk show?
Yeah, I mean, I love the documentaries. I got to do this, you know, Hello Privilege, It's Me, Chelsea, which came out last year on Netflix, was my last project I did at Netflix. And that was a really meaningful project. I mean, we're actually talking about releasing more scenes now because that was for white people about white privilege. Like I wanted to understand and examine the subject of white privilege because I always thought it was one thing. You know, I thought it was like, oh, families that go to Harvard, Yale, or like Rockefellers or legacy families, like that was privilege. I didn't realize, oh, you don't have to be that one of those families to experience white privilege. So there's all these nuances and it's a broad spread and it's a long spectrum. And so that movie was like me asking, oh, what's my part in this? What's my put, like, how much did this play into my success and my, and all everything? And it's like, it plays a lot into it. So it's a big wake up call at how kind of asleep at the wheel I was. And, you know, here I am thinking I'm woke. It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah. I mean, that movie, that documentary was really, especially feels ahead of its time now. And I really enjoyed it at the time and actually rewatched it last week and just got a lot out of it again. And I think seeing it in even a different light now in this moment, what did you learn about white privilege doing that you think maybe seems like a lot of other celebrities especially are learning now and trying to communicate now?
Well, what I learned for me personally was that it's always important to ask a question, you know, like don't worry about being an idiot. Who cares? That's your ego. It doesn't matter. If you're trying to get to the goodness of a situation, then let's just all be honest and like respectful. I learned a lot. I learned like, you know, I'm like a touchy-feely person. And like that's, as far as the movement for men goes, like it applies to women too. Mm-hmm. But like women, I'm like carrying on like, oh yeah, I can just touch people. And this one black woman was like, you can't touch me like that. You know, she's like, you can't touch my body like that. Like, I'm not okay with it. You don't know my history, what I've been through, if I've been assaulted or whatever. And I'm like, what? You know, immediately you're defensive because you're like, my intention wasn't to assault you. It's not about your intention, though. It's about the reception. And your intention doesn't mean anything a lot of the time. And we have to learn to accept that, you know? So I've learned all these things about communicating with people in a better, more honest way, not trying to virtue signal, but try to understand what you're saying, you know? I mean, it's all virtue signaling at some point, but to really know what you're saying so you can direct conversations and have thought-provoking, meaningful interactions with people instead of just screaming and yelling, which is also a takeaway from my therapy, you know? Yeah. I went in there and I was like, I want to be able to talk to Trump supporters without the veins throbbing out of my neck, you know? Mm-hmm. I need help. And it was a lesson in diplomacy.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've gotten to that point where you can talk to Trump supporters without going insane?
Yeah. I mean, I'm better. I'm not there yet. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I've made some improvements and I'm able to remain calm no matter pretty much what anyone says to me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've made some improvements, but I still have a way to go.
I love that you include some of that really personal stuff in there too, about your own experience and that the story about your boyfriend when you were a teenager who was black and how differently his life ended up going from yours. Why did you want to include that? And was that scary to to make it personal in that way?
I did not want to include that. I never want to include my ex-boyfriends, but somehow I always agree to it. Every single time it comes up, I'm like, no, luckily I'm out of ex-boyfriends. So there are none left to be on camera. Mm-hmm. My director, Alex Stapleton, it was her idea. And she took me through my history of, my experience with Black people. And if I grew up with them and how many Black people went to my high school. And so I kind of had split my high school years. And the second part of my high school years, I was exposed to a whole different kind of culture. And I dated this Black guy for 2 years, Tyshawn. And I got pregnant twice with him. He was a drug dealer. I lived like with him. I just like left my family. I was completely out of control. And eventually my family was like, you have to come home now. So I told her that story and she's like, what? I can't believe you haven't told me that. And I was like, well, that hasn't come up. Like that I dated a Black drug dealer when I was 16 to 18. She's like, it's relevant to this story. Cause I told her, oh, we had both gotten stopped for like dime bags of marijuana, like twice. And both times they let me go. And both times they arrested him. Mm-hmm. And then, that interfered with his scholarship at college and he didn't go to college. Like once you get into that system, you don't come out. At the time I was young and stupid and I didn't really think about him or what that meant and what the situation was. I just thought like, oh, I have a good personality. Cops like me. I had no idea how easy it is to get out of a situation if you're a white woman in this world, a crime situation, that is. Anyway, so it was really nerve-wracking to have to go and meet with him. I hadn't seen him since I was 17 years old, but it was really also heartwarming. Like, as you could see on camera with his family, like, it was just so sweet to see his mom and that she was clean and off drugs. Mm-hmm. And that I was part of their family was like, it felt nice to be reminded of where I came from.
I was always not able to skirt out of the trouble.
That's right.
Like, I remember getting pulled over like 4 or 5 times on my way home to the house when I had been drinking. I had like 5 people in the car, and every single time I got through it.
No, but you had the complexion for the connection.
Wow, I was in some pretty hairy situations that I never, ever paid the price for.
Never. Like I said, I went that different way, and I'm glad it turned out the way it did with you.
Thank you.
The meeting when you see him for the first time, you caught that on camera. I mean,
yeah,
it must have been.
Yeah.
Did you feel at all weird about meeting him in that way and filming it? And were they all cool with it?
Yeah.
And
how? Always. I always feel weird about it. But then I'm always like, oh, I want to be open-minded. I want to be fearless in what I do, no matter how it comes across, like to have the guts to do something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because you can't fake that. So I wanted to just kind of like, I'm not going to say no to a challenge. And it wasn't a challenge. It was just me feeling my, it's typical white guilt bullshit. So it was good that I had to go face him and be like, yeah, look at me and look at you, like two completely different worlds now.
Mm-hmm. And I think it does, it exemplifies that journey that you take in the documentary from the beginning where you're at that meeting with the students who are not thrilled with you in a lot of ways. And putting that in there was also, I think, brave to show the backlash that you can receive when you, think you're doing something good.
Yeah.
Trying to do something good. And I think that's obviously something you've probably dealt with throughout your career. And now, especially as you try to put something good out in the world and there's always people that are going to be upset about it.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, listen, you just assume that. I mean, if everybody liked what you were doing, then how interesting would that be? You assume the bad is coming. So any good that comes along with that is always just a bonus. Mm.
Yeah. And I think celebrities right now are dealing with that in an interesting way of facing their white privilege for the first time. I'm thinking about Jimmy Fallon had to, apologize for doing blackface on SNL a long time ago. And so I'm curious if you have any advice for people of sort of how to handle these situations and how to, whether it's through social media or through what they say, what would you tell people?
I mean, I think we all just have to be forgive people for making mistakes, an apology. Yeah. Apologize right away. People are offended. We know now that it's not acceptable anymore. We all apologize. We're all sorry for not knowing more sooner. Like, why did it take this long? I'm so disappointed in us that it took this long for us to get it together. If white kids were dying like that by police officers, like the police would have been reformed, disbanded everything years ago. So that's like a violation of human rights in our own country. So The anger, like what you're talking about in the documentary, filming that, the people's angry reaction towards me. Mm-hmm. I get that. I got that now. You know, that was something I didn't understand before filming. And then I got, oh, this is such, like, years and years and intergenerational, like, oppression. Mm-hmm. We've never allowed them to be people. Yeah. And we're all part of it. And that's the, you know, that's the worst news. But it's also the best news, because that means we can make changes right away.
Mm-hmm. I saw even, you know, just this week, you've gotten some backlash for posting that Louis Farrakhan video.
Yes, yes.
What's your reaction to that? I mean,
well, I thought his message was really powerful. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about the anti-Semitic thing, but I don't want to take down the thing because I felt the message was powerful, and a lot of people did. And mm-hmm. it was powerful for me, the way he spelled it out, you know, that Black people don't have a history of killing white people. White mm-hmm. people have a history of killing Black people for hundreds of years. Forget about crime. Over and over again, we kill Black people in this country.
Mm.
So everyone needs to, like, remember where the violence came from.
Yeah.
It's not from the Black people. It's from the white people. So I thought it was powerful. So whatever, you know, everybody can go fuck themselves.
Coming up, Chelsea teases her new stand-up special, which will be premiering on HBO Max as soon as she figures out a way to shoot it safely.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
So you also have, I just found out not too long ago, that you have a stand-up special that just got announced.
With HBO Max.
Yeah, so that's exciting. Although who knows when you can perform live again. So what's the deal there?
Well, we're looking for outdoor spaces, you know, to perform, to do the special.
Like Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, that's perfect example of it, because it's the safest way to shoot a special. Otherwise, it's limited capacity. You know, obviously, they're going to open up some places. We're actually talking to New York and New Jersey to see if I want to go home to do it as a reopening in August. I want to film the special in August. So I think I will shoot it this summer, and I will announce it, like, you know, probably next month or at the end of this month if I end up shooting it in August. But yeah, I want to shoot it before the election, and I want it out before the election, because it's just about changing your mindset and, like, putting your mind to better use. And it's all about waking up to life. Right.
When you announced it, you said, the quote was, "I didn't want to return to stand up until I had something important to say. I do now." So what is the important thing that you have to say now?
The important thing to talk about is, first of all, taking stock of, like, your accountability, having self-awareness, dealing with any of your grief or your trauma, not putting it away and shoving it aside, because it always comes back to bite you in the ass, and doing it with humor, and doing it, you know, with a smile when you have to, and crying when you have to, but also getting to the other side and discovering how to be better at being a human being. And, you know, my unhealthy relationship with my dogs, my cleaning ladies, and cannabis, you know, sprinkled with all of the usual nonsense, because that's always going to be who I am, because I can't get my shit together.
Yeah.
But I like to write about the true things that happened to me, because, I mean, whether you like me or not, you nobody can say that I'm a liar. Like, I'm only always telling about my authentic experience. You know, I'm oversharing, people would argue. So the idea of writing this book and being able to overshare something that was so profound and meaningful to me, was something I hadn't put out into the world yet. Like, I was like, oh, this is nice to do something that's well-meaning.
How do you work on material when you can't get up on stage in front of people? Because usually, you know, stand-ups are going out and doing clubs and trying to see what works in front of audiences.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's fine. I was going to go on tour. Obviously, my tour has been canceled because of Corona, but it's okay. I've done about 55 of the shows, so I'm ready to record it. I would just warm it up for a week at a comedy club or somewhere in the country that's open and safe. Yeah, I mean, you work, I have that set pretty kind of ready to rumble, so there's not much writing that needs to be done on it. After that, I'll start writing again and move on to, I mean, people are going to be so COVIDed out by the fall that it's like, I don't even want to write during this time until I'm in a new phase of my life.
You're not writing a bunch of coronavirus jokes?
No, I'm not actually. No, I spend every free moment I have reading because I know I'll never be able to have time like this to read.
Yeah. You really haven't done stand-up like this in a long time, though. So how does it feel to be sort of on the precipice of shooting a special?
Oh, it's going to be the best thing I've ever done. I mean, it's so solid. I had never toured and not been like, you know, drinking during my tour, or by the second show being like, you know, totally buzzed. I had never behaved myself. I had never like had a set list and did everything in the right order. I would just like go out there and do whatever I felt like. And sometimes that was great and sometimes it wasn't. But this was like, I was super focused. I'm not partying like that anymore. Like, I'm not going to go out, you know? So I was really focused on getting the message from the book into a stand-up. Like, once I saw what Nanette did, Hannah Gadsby, I was like, oh, you can make stand-up have an arc like that. And I wanted to take the book and put that into a stand-up form. And I did. And I think it's really powerful. And I feel like it's the extension of the book. It's the last kind of like, okay, let's put that down and then we'll move on to the next thing.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel like the book is, this most recent book is very different from your older books, which were more straight, you know, comedy. There is much more personal, much more intense stuff in this book. And I assume that would be the same for the stand-up. Do you feel like that's a deliberate decision that you've gone in that direction of just getting more real with stuff, getting more personal, you know, not making it all just sort of jokes for joke's sake?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wanted to peel away like the layers, you know, you take off the veneer, you realize, oh, you were drinking so much when you were younger because it was like, you know, you were numbing and you're like, I don't need that anymore. I've come face to face with my demons in a way, you know, I've like faced it. It's like, oh, that's not appealing to me anymore. So it's deeper, but it's much sharper. Like, the comedy is so much, to me, funnier. Also, as a comedian, having to take out all of my insensitive and racially insensitive jokes and this person, whatever insensitive jokes, like you can't operate that way anymore. Mm. So it's even better. Your material's even stronger because you have to really come up with clever stuff because you can't go to the bottom feeding stuff. And that's the way it should fucking be, you know, in my personal. Yeah.
Do you feel like back in the day you would do that sort of lowest common denominator stuff, or you would fall back on that, or that it was easy?
Yeah. I don't think I challenged myself as a writer necessarily. My personality was bigger than whatever I was saying anyway. You know what I mean? So I just had a lot of misplaced confidence. So people were like, oh, okay, great. But there's definitely an evolution. And now I'm sharp. It's like, now I've got my mind on like straight. So what I'm saying, I feel is more impactful. And it's like, I feel like I have, you know, a special that has, it can be intensely emotional when I talk about the day my brother died. But it ends with one of the most humiliating stories of my life on an airplane with a man who was farting next to me for 5 hours. So it goes in all different directions, but in the same time. So it's the true essence of who I've always been, but like a cut above. But yeah, holding on to the stuff that makes you you.
So I want to go back now and just go through a couple of your earlier credits and see if there's a story or memory that pops to mind. So speaking of stand-up, do you remember your first time performing stand-up on television and what that was like?
Oh, Jay Leno show. Yeah, I was on the Jay Leno show. Yeah, I remember what I was wearing. I was wearing this really bad coral stretchy top. And I came out and did a monologue. But I had been on his show like 5 or 6 times as a correspondent.
Oh, yeah.
So they knew me. So I was kind of like getting in there. But they were so good to me at that show. I was on that show like 21 times or something.
Oh, wow.
And I did it with him. I did stand up on the Jay Leno show. So that was the place to go at that time.
Yeah, big deal.
I'm officially old.
How did that first set go the first time you performed?
It was good, I think. Yeah, it was good. It went well. And then, Jay always was like, you don't have to be so blue, you know, like, you don't have to be birdie. And I was like, fuck you, Jay. Like, don't give me any advice. I don't want to be like you.
Yeah. Well, then you ultimately had your own show, your first show, Chelsea Lately.
I had a show before that, the Chelsea Handler show on E! Mm-hmm. And that was like ran for one season. And then from that show, we decided to do Chelsea Lately instead. So like that show led to Chelsea Lately, but they were totally different.
When you think about your time on Chelsea Lately, which was many years, what stands out to you from that experience? I mean, it must be kind of a blur in some ways, but
the sophomoric chicanery, just going in and in the morning answering other people's emails. I go from desk to desk to desk and just write terrible, completely inappropriate. If I had a show today, first of all, it would have been taken away from me.
Yeah.
I have no boundaries at work. We would play jokes on each other. I mean, we would walk around naked. We were out of control. It was like a fraternity house.
Mm-hmm. Towards the end, did you kind of clash with E? And was it a difficult relationship towards the end?
Well, I announced I was leaving, like, I think on the Howard Stern show. And so that
they didn't like that.
They knew I was done. I really did. And they were so pissed when they found out that I said that, because they thought I was doing it as a negotiating tactic. And I wasn't. I was done. And I was just telling people. Mm-hmm. But I did it. I should have told some people before I announced it on Howard Stern. But, you know, that's me. I just can't help myself.
Yeah. And then there was your Netflix show, which I really enjoyed. And I just had a couple months ago had Fortune Feimster on this podcast. Yeah. And she's great. And we talked about, so I came to the show the night that Ann Coulter was supposed to be on. And then she canceled the last minute. And I think that's why I was there. Like, I was supposed to go cover what would happen when Ann Coulter went on your show. And then she canceled the last minute and Fortune came on as Ann Coulter, basically. So what do you remember about that night? And what did you think at the time when Ann Coulter canceled?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I was like, are you kidding? Is she scared of me? I'm like, Ann Coulter scared of me? And they're like, we think so. Like, she had agreed to come on, but then, canceled. So I take a lot of pride in that.
Yeah, actually. That she was too scared to come on.
Yeah. If I'm going to be scaring people, I hope I'm scaring her.
Yeah. The other bit from that show that I wanted to ask about, just because it somehow has come up again this week, is you did a whole monologue about how Trump probably has syphilis. And that has affected a lot of his behavior. And this week we saw the slow walk down the ramp, which raised new questions about his health. And people are, you know, very concerned
You're like,
about
what's
him.
On that ramp? Like an obstacle course? Yeah. Why are you walking like that?
So I've seen more people raising the syphilis thing, that could be affecting him. So
Well, you know, the way he stands is a symptom of dementia. Like the way he stands with
sort
his ass out.
Forward. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a symptom of dementia. Mm-hmm. So, and late stage syphilis is basically tantamount to dementia. So it's basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing by my theory that he has late stage syphilis, which has turned into dementia.
Yeah. I think, you were ahead of the game on that one too. So I think people.
Yeah. Look at me. Look at me.
And finally, syphilis can impair your judgment and memory, which might make someone forget things that they've said in the past.
I never said repeal and replace Obamacare. You've all heard my speeches. I never said repeal it and replace it within 64 days.
We will be able to immediately repeal and replace Obamacare.
I'm very pro-choice.
I am pro-life.
Hillary Clinton, I think, is a terrific woman.
Replenish the
Such
Social
a nasty
Security
woman.
Trust Fund.
Don't worry about that, baby. I love babies, so. I love babies. I hear that baby crying. I like.
Actually, I was only kidding. You can get the baby out of here.
Doctor, so I can't claim Donald Trump has syphilis because of laws. But as the saying goes, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it probably fucked some questionable models in the 80s.
So we end every episode by asking comedians, who is a comedian who has made you laugh the hardest in your life? It could be someone that you've worked with or someone that you've, you know, seen perform. Who's the person that comes to mind that just really, that makes you laugh?
Fortune Feimster makes me laugh a lot. She's the first person that came to mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's pretty funny.
Are there any stories with her that stand out from your experience together?
We had a cannabis dinner one night. We did a Chelsea Does series on Netflix, mm-hmm. and we did like a cannabis there was one episode where I did drugs called Chelsea mm-hmm. Does Drugs. And we got really stoned.
I'm going to get really high. I got my weed card just for you.
You did for this dinner?
Yeah, I went to a shady weed place in the valley. And my guy was like, tell me your symptoms in two words or less. And they have a list of what's okay symptoms and what's not. I go, headaches. Yeah. Then I go, and he goes, no.
And she at my house, after we went into the kitchen and the four of us were just basically eating a pie with our hands, we were so stoned. I mean, I wasn't right for 3 days. I woke up the next day and I was like, I can't film today. I'm like, I couldn't open my eyes. And she was not right for like a week. Yeah. And she has no tolerance for that stuff. So she was out of control. She kept walking out with like large items from my house, like desks, chairs.
Yeah, edibles will get you like that.
Yeah, I like edibles. Cannabis-infused anything is dangerous, but I do like edibles where they're more concentrated. Mm-hmm. But I don't want cannabis-infused food. Like, I want to be alert.
Yeah, yeah. And especially not a whole meal of it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, and congrats on the book and the special. I'm looking forward to seeing more footage from Hello Privilege when that comes out.
Yeah, it was nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Okay,
have a good one.
Care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Chelsea Handler for being my guest on The Last Laugh. Her new special, Evolution, is available to stream now on HBO Max. If you're enjoying this podcast, how about giving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts? We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.